Okay, Sylvia. Sylvia, are you there?
I am here. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Sylvia. Sylvia's here to give us a little discussion. Now, Sylvia, we start out every morning with letting people know where you're from and kind of, you know, let them get a little to know about you a little bit. So can you talk about yourself?
Okay. Well, I've been pretty busy. As many folks already know, I'm actually originally from Canada. My parents were both immigrants to Canada and met in the mid-1950s in Niagara Falls, Ontario. And not long thereafter, I was born. So I moved to the gorgeous Greene County 21 years ago now. But I have been coming here since I was a young child because my mother and my husband's mother and aunt all knew each other back in the old country. And my mother-in-law owns the Crystal Brook and used to own the Mountain Brow House. Now my brother-in-law does and his wife and kids. So, you know, I've been coming up here since I was a young child. So I've always loved it here and I'm happy to be here. But I've been pretty busy over the last while working on a number of projects. Just finished up the Carroll Herald, I should say, which is actually was an original newspaper from Carroll. And it is our historical journal. We use that title because it was the only newspaper that gave a darn about Carroll. That was the byline of that newspaper.
Was it?
It was. Okay. So we are actually using that as the title of our quarterly historical journal for the Carroll Historical Society. So just wrapped that up late last night, a 22-pager, lots of really cool stories, including the first of a two-part story about what happened to the rolling stock of the various railroads from Greene County. So Roger Liller is our railroad guy. He's also our vice president and secretary of the Carroll Historical Society. Okay. And he's written a two-part article that has John Hamm's wonderful photos of the trains that basically says when the engines were bought, what happened to them, and where they went after the railroad shut down. So that's one of our signature stories within there. But we have a lot of other great stories about Caro and what's going on. So that's something I just finished up and getting ready, to be honest with you, to be Martha Washington on Saturday at the State of the Union Dinner, which is our Caro Historical Society annual fundraiser. And I'm in full velvet, I'm telling you. It's a great fundraiser. I think this is our sixth year of doing it. My husband is a graduate of the Culinary Institute. He's chefing, so it's a choice roast beef or ham dinner. Nice. With homemade mashed potatoes, green beans with silvered almonds, honey glazed carrots, salad roll, pie with whipped cream, and a beverage. So it is a fundraiser, though, for a nonprofit, which is our Carroll Historical Society. So if anybody's interested, reach out to me. It's this Saturday between 4 and 8 o'clock in the basement of the Masonic Hall, which is now the American Legion, and we use that particular site because it has a great kitchen we can use, as well as you know, tables, and you know, we served last year 130 dinners in 4 hours.
Nice.
Yep, eat in, take out, whichever you like. So anyways, that's something that's coming up that I'm involved in, so I'm pretty excited. But and of course, one of the things I'm getting ready for is on March the 10th, I'm going to be doing a genealogy workshop for the Carroll Historical Society, and it's going to be at the Carroll Library, a free will donation. And being a, you know, professional genealogist and historian, you know, there are people that have already reached out to me and said, hey, I want to be there because you might be help me figure out my brick wall. And I said, well, that's what this is all about. So bring your laptop, bring your genealogy program on there, and give me a call, and I'll reserve a spot. 4 spots of the 15 spots are already taken. My number is 518-821-3852, and we're going to make this a fun, interactive workshop. And it'll be March the 10th, 1 o'clock, Carroll Library.
Now, I always hear about genealogy over the computer or on television.
Right.
Blah, you know, what does that involve, actually? What is your goal for that, and what is...
Well, you know, I think a lot of people, and this in large part is because of the efforts of the Mormons and the work that they've done in cataloging and imaging on microfilm, now they're digitizing records from all over the world. I mean, they're inside a mountain, you know, in Utah. This is absolutely the truth.
I did not know that.
I've been there. I've been in Salt Lake City.
I've heard stories, but I wasn't quite sure about it.
They have the hollowed out inside of a mountain. They have all these microfilms of church records, civil records, military records, land records, you name the records. They got them. And so I started doing this like 35 years ago, you know, the hard way before computers even existed. But their efforts to do that have helped fuel, I think, the whole genealogy mania that we have today. Yeah, because, you know, the records are available, and that's the big part. And Ancestry.com and, you know, MyHeritage and other sites like that, including the Mormon site, which is FamilySearch.org, gives you the opportunity to pilot your own investigation to your family tree. And having programs such as Tracing Your Roots on TV, you know, helps, because people all of a sudden go, oh, is that how you do it? And, boy, that's interesting. And who are my ancestors? And people are really interested in figuring out who they are and where they come from.
So that is how you do it, then? You just take a sample and you go with it from there?
Well, when I do genealogy, what I always say to people is start with what you know. You know, you get yourself a program. A lot of people still do it on paper, but I find working with a program online, like on my computer, not necessarily on an offsite, but on my computer, I can control the information. I own the information. Nobody can take the information. So you start with what you know. You get your birth records, death records, marriage records that are in your family, and you start keying in information from you as a central person. And then, you know, who is your parents? You key in their vital information. Who is your mother? Who is your grandparents on both sides? Who's your uncles? Who's your aunts? Who's your cousins? And you just start putting all that information in there, and then you start going back in time. Because as you use those records, it usually gives you a clue to the previous generation. So it's a very methodical process, genealogy, and if you follow the method very distinctly, getting those records, you usually can push your own genealogy back. I can usually push someone, say, from Carroll, their genealogy, if they've been here like many, many generations, I can take them back to the Revolution.
Really?
In 15 minutes.
In 15 minutes?
I can.
Wow.
Absolutely. It's not hard.
I knew I invited you for a reason.
But I know how to do it. I do it professionally.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been doing it a long time. As I said, I did it the hard way, but all my family's in Europe, so I never did North American genealogy till I moved here.
Right.
You know, and then when I moved here 20 years ago, I established the Tracing Your Roots in Greene County website. And right now it's down because Ancestry purchased RootsWeb, which hosts those sites, and saying that there's a problem with a breach of security, but it's been down since like November, and they still have not put the sites back up. So I'm in the midst of trying to figure out how to get a server and whether I can afford a server, you know, and put the site back up, because there's 3,000 pages about Greene County history and genealogy.
Well, that's very important. You definitely have to be getting that up at some time soon, hopefully.
Yeah, I'm hoping to. Yeah, that's because people have been asking me what happened to it. So that's another big project I have to kind of noodle around and figure out, because I have the whole site. It's not like I've lost anything, but I'm not a computer person. You know, I do a whole lot of other things, but not that. It's not my forte particularly.
Yeah, okay. I wanted to let you know that I had been telling the audience, and I let you know this when you came in, but I had been telling the audience that we were going to do something on Uncle Sam.
I'm sorry, I forgot.
No, that's all right. That's all right. But
we'll do it next time.
Yeah, that's for a later time.
I'll put it in my calendar this time, because I was talking to Neva the other day, and she says, okay, what are we talking about? And I'm going, what have I done interesting? Well, I've done a really cool three-part story for the Greenville Pioneer that I thought we could talk about. So.
And yes, you did mention that briefly. The Great Divorce.
The Great Divorce. Eunice Holly Chapman, who became the first and only legislative divorce in New York State. And she was from Durham.
Really?
Well, she lived there.
What's a legislative divorce?
It's the legislature grants you a divorce. So it's not through the court system.
And you said it was the first and only
legislative divorce.
That's what I'm trying to figure out. Okay. So it was the only time it's ever happened. It's only happened once.
Right.
And it was done by the legislation versus the civil courts.
Correct.
Okay.
In 18 or 19. I can't remember off the top of my head. But yeah, it was like really early, and there's a really cool backstory.
Okay, do tell. And let's hear the mystery and the...
I think we have some news first, so we can play the news. However, this is our Radio Magic Pledge Drive, and our listeners are encouraged enthusiastically to make their pledge of support for Creative Community Radio in Green and Columbia Counties, WGXC, ACRA, 90.7 FM, and WGXC.org. What's the number to call?
The number that you can reach us at is 518-697-7400, or you can go online at WGXC.org/donate. Sylvia, did you have anything you wanted to say to us? Anything that what the station means to you? Or?
Absolutely. You know, how many times do you have the opportunity to come in and share one story? And in my case, it's my historical journey. And I share it with a wide audience, and I think they like it. I enjoy doing this a great deal. And you don't have the opportunity to really come into a radio station and, you know, tell your story, whether it's my historical story or a musical journey or whatever, you know, and there's lots of different people that come in and tell different stories. And I think it's important for the community to be able to share our own journey. And so you are very local. You belong to us. We belong to you. And it is a joint effort. And I encourage everybody to share the love.
And you can do that by giving us a call here at 518-697-7400. It's very, very important that you contact us because we are listener supported, and that's 518-697-7400. Sylvia, I could not have said it better than what you just said.
No, thank you.
Nobody could say it better. That's why Sylvia is Sylvia. Our total went up. Right now, the tally is 28.55.
Yay. And I am Mr. Petey Pete, and I am your Tuesday morning programmer. And I am joined here by Sylvia Hassenkopf, who is a Hudson Valley historian, as well as my partner in crime, Neva, is also surgically connected to my hip right now. So she is here also. And we were going to get into, I have here on a monthly edition, we talk about Greene County history. Okay, so Sylvia, we are running out of time, so we need to shuffle in a lot of information here about this month's
story. Yeah,
topic.
So. Well, it's a titillating story. Let's say that it's titillating on a number of fronts. A friend of mine, her name is Sylvia Story McGinn, a Catskill native, a good friend, and I always love everybody named Sylvia. And amazingly enough, I have like three friends named Sylvia, and she picked up a book at a yard sale last year, and she read it, and she says, you know, I want you to read this because it's about somebody from Durham, New York, from way back. And she says, I know you're going to love it. And I said, okay. So I picked it up and I'm looking at the front. It's a book written by a woman named Ilyan Wu, and it's entitled The Great Divorce. And it really tells the story of a young lady named Eunice Holly Chapman. She was born Eunice Holly, and she was the woman credited with having the one and only legislative divorce in New York State. And people go to me, wow, why is that interesting? Well, because you don't get a divorce in the legislature. You get a divorce through the civil courts. And divorce is kind of an interesting notion in New York State anyway, let alone throughout the world. Did you know that the Philippines to this day does not allow divorce?
Really?
Really. And that divorce only was finally allowed in Chile in 2004, in Ireland in 1996, in Spain in 1981, in Portugal in 1975, and in Italy in 1970.
I guess that really does mean until death do you part.
In those countries, it certainly did. But the one common factor, I think, in these countries, except for maybe the Philippines, is that they are predominantly Roman Catholic.
There you go.
But now divorce is indeed allowed in those countries. But even in New York State, up until I think it was the 1970s, and believe me, I'm no divorce lawyer, you could not get a divorce except for, like, adultery.
Okay.
It's a very odd notion that, you know, it would take only that. And I mean, how many times did you hear growing up how people had to go find somebody to pretend they had an affair with so they could actually get a divorce?
Yeah. You know? If I had a quarter every time that happened to me, I'd Still wouldn't have my. Afforded.
But as of August 15, 2010, we now have no-fault divorce in New York State. New York State was one of the states that took a long time to come around to actually allowing divorce for other grounds other than, you know, adultery. So it was one of those interesting
And that's things. A whole nother conversation we it can is. Have about the pros and cons of no-fault divorce. Yes.
But anyways, well, back to Eunice. Now, divorce in North America really depends on whether you were living during the time of the Dutch or you're living during the time of, you know, the British rule. Because under the Dutch, women held a much more equitable position in society. They could own their own property even when they were married. They ran their own businesses. They could inherit from their fathers. But British women couldn't.
Okay.
They could inherit. But the men and everything that they inherited belonged to their husband.
Okay.
So that was the way divorce was, you know, was kind of interesting because women were considered civilly dead once they were married. And this was a term that was coined by Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was one of the early organizers of the women's suffrage movement.
Yep.
And they were having a conference, I guess you could call it, in July of 1848. And she was talking about the condition of women in New York State. And she coined that term, civilly dead. But basically, it means that a woman doesn't own anything once she gets married. You know, everything she owned before marriage is her husband's. If she was working during her marriage, it was owned by her husband. If she inherited property or monies while she was married, it was owned by her husband.
And I wonder if that has to also go in with the husband, the woman takes the husband's name in a lot of cases.
Well, in North America, certainly.
Yeah.
But there was it really goes back to a good explanation by an English jurist named William Blackstone, who in his 18th century legal trustees' commentaries on English law said, by marriage, the husband and wife are one person in the law. That is, the very being or legal existence of the woman is suspended during the marriage, or at least is incorporated and consolidated into that of the husband, under whose wing, protection, and cover she performs everything. So I think that's kind of interesting how times have changed, don't you think? But anyways, basically, that was the condition that, or the world that Eunice Hawley was living in. You know, she was a young lady born on November 22nd, 1778 in Stratford, Connecticut. She was the third daughter in the family of eight children. Her father was a rather entrepreneurial type of man. His name was Elijah Hawley. He was a dry goods merchant and a skilled carpenter in his own right. But he also ran a boarding house on the side for sailors. So he's always looking how to make a little bit of money. But after the Revolution, a lot of families were moving west. You know, they were looking to expand. They were looking for new opportunities. And it's like, you know, the lands were starting to open up on the west side of the Hudson. You know, during the Revolution and prior to the Revolution, settlement in Greene County really only went 2 to 3 miles from the river. There was no major roads. There was a few settlements here and there, and mostly just individual homes or homesteads. But real communities didn't exist, you know.
I mean, but for the most part, a lot of towns and so forth always opened up by the waterfront. I mean,
correct.
For transportation or for
that was the way to get around,
or,
yes.
Or for a lot of different reasons.
Exactly.
But a majority of throughout the world, actually, mm-hmm. usually start around
right.
the water. Oh, go ahead.
But what started happening after the American Revolution, you know, people were leaving, you know, New England, New Jersey, Long Island. They were looking for a fresh start. Young sons had no more land. You know, the lands had all been used up where they were, and they were looking to establish their own homesteads and their own families. And when they got to the promised land, so to speak, which could be Durham, New York, they were saying, hey, you know, there's a lot of land here. There's a lot of opportunity here. And then, you know, the Susquehanna Turnpike opened up, and that was the road that cut through Greene County and went all the way to, not Watkins Glen, but there's a ferry. Watkins Ferry, what's it? Do you know that name? Out in Delaware?
No.
Oh, geez, Louise. I'm doing research in Watkins Glen, so that's
know,
the name
that
it's in my head right
up.
Now.
Okay.
But anyways, Wappingers Ferries or something? I don't know. There's a place out in Delaware on the Susquehanna River, and the Susquehanna Turnpike literally went from Catskill all the way through Greene County, Delaware County, to, you know, the river right by Otsego County.
Okay.
And so people were using that all the time. So communities were being established along the Susquehanna Turnpike. Caro was right on the Susquehanna Turnpike. Durham was right on the Susquehanna Turnpike. These were communities specifically established and grown because of the traffic. But, you know, a few intrepid, you know, settlers had arrived in Durham in the late 1770s. But the real growth of Durham started around 1800 with the opening of the turnpike.
Right.
And that's when Eunice's father moved. Now, someone must have written back home and said, hey, you know, things are really good. You can make a fortune out here. You know, all these travelers, we're talking about thousands of people going back and forth on this turnpike because it was the only way to get through. And so he sold everything in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and moved his family there. But, you know, we had tough economic times in America at that time. And so Elijah was in, you know, partnership with his son and another man, running, you know, a dry goods kind of establishment. And the partner, not his son, but his partner, took off with $10,000 cash and left him with all the debt.
Ouch.
So his standing in the community went from one of wealth and prestige and honor to going to debtor's prison. You know, so it took a while for him to get out. I think he was in there for 6 months.
And if people don't know, I mean, I guess there's some type of simulation of debtor's prison today, but debtor's prison is actually, if you owed money, they would put you
in prison,
in labor.
I haven't really done an article on how you got out. And it could be that, you know, you had to sell your property. I think that's what happened. You had to sell your property, or you had to secure some kind of monies from somebody that paid off your creditor so you could get out of prison.
Right.
It was really a rough time. It's not like today, you know, where you can go bankrupt very easily.
Well, and I think it's called debtor's prison now. It's called Equifax, right?
Yeah,
is that what it's called?
I don't know.
Okay, go ahead.
So anyways, you know, Eunice was all of a sudden in a position where she was in her mid-20s. Her younger sisters had been married off, and, you know, she had not yet been married. And, you know, to be in your mid-20s as a woman in those days, you were really getting up there, you know, and it was getting a little bit of a desperate situation. So she was looking around for a good catch, and she saw James Chapman. And James Chapman was somebody who, you know, was very well established. He was a merchant. He was a widower. He was 15 years her senior. And she, you know, she gave him the eye, and he was enthralled. By all accounts, Eunice Holly was charming, witty, sexy, and he really wanted her, you know, and he married her. But she also had a spirit that I think he couldn't crush, and their marriage was problematic. There was no question about it. And I think he brought to the marriage the fact that he was a drinker. But during the marriage, his drinking got worse. Nobody really knows what Eunice was like as an individual. You just kind of look at what she did and how she did it,
right,
to realize there must have been a fair amount of a strong will and
so you're saying
independence.
Eunice drove him to drinking.
Well, I think he was a drinker beforehand.
He lost
a wife he really loved when his daughter was born in the, I think it was the 1790s.
Okay.
So he took to drink, but he had controlled it. He was a functioning alcoholic at that point.
Okay.
But I think married to her, she was such a different woman than
strong-willed
his previous wife. Women were expected to be more meek and obedient to their husbands. So a strong-willed woman was viewed more as a harridan than anything else, you know.
Right.
Isn't that a great old word, eh? Harridan. And so their marriage was very problematic. They did have three children, you know. They were married in 1804. And the last child was born in 1809. And by 1810, he was having a real hard time staying home. He was womanizing. He was drinking in excess. She was trying to cover up things by helping him manage his businesses. According to the author of the book, you know, he would have intimate relations with his wife and then get on his knees afterwards and pray to God, saying that, you know, why am I with this wicked woman and things like that. So he was really conflicted about, you know, the whole thing. And so after a while, he basically sold everything he owned, absolutely everything, the house, the businesses, at a loss, and left nothing for his children and his wife to survive on, and took off to New York City.
Wow.
And down there for a whole year, he had the time of his life. His wife, on the other hand, by the good graces of the man who bought the house that she was living in, allowed her to stay there rent-free. The only piece of furniture she had was her marriage bed, because that was the only thing she could keep. Everything else was sold out from under her.
Okay.
Because he sold it all. And he took off. So one of the tenets of marriage in those days is to support your family. You were required to support your family, but he didn't. He took off. But at the end of that year, he came back with his newfound faith. And his newfound faith was in the Shakers.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm really fast forwarding because I have like three articles in the Greenville Pioneer on this story. So all available. The first two articles are out. The next one will be out in 2 weeks. But the Shakers are an interesting group because yes. I didn't realize until I did this story that the Shakers are actually a breakoff group from the Quakers.
Mm-hmm.
Because the early days of the Quakers back in England, they were so overcome with emotion and passion for their religion and for God, they would quake and shake.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they got the name Quakers. It was actually a disparaging term by one of their critics saying, oh, you Quakers. And they embraced the name rather than throwing it away. And the Shakers, being a breakaway sect, became the Shakers. They took the shaking part. And they broke away because as time went on, the original Quaker group started to calm down, if we could call it that. They didn't do such outward showing of emotion and quaking and dancing like they did in the early days. They kind of calmed down and became more meditative and, you know, sat on their benches and talked and meditated with God and that sort of thing. But they didn't show this outward show of emotion like they used to. And so the new group broke away saying, well, we wanted to continue doing that. And that new group was established by James and Jane Wardley in 1747. And what really blew me away is they established it in Bolton, England, the birthplace of Thomas Cole.
Oh, okay.
I thought, wow, isn't that cool? I thought that was really neat.
Right.
So anyways, they broke away and they started their whole Shaker movement. And they shared many of the same foundations of the faith, which is, you know, equality of women. They also believed in pacifism, which means you don't fight in wars and you don't hit each other. They didn't believe in violence and things like that. So these are things that both the Shakers and the Quakers believed in. But, you know, the one thing the Shakers embraced wholeheartedly was the notion that everybody within the Shaker movement had to be celibate.
Okay.
So that becomes a problem for maintaining your religion. Is if you have no children, who continues on
right.
the religion? And this became a little bit of a challenge for them as time went on. But, you know, there was a lot of women and there were a lot of men who embraced this whole notion of being celibate. They were okay with that. The women would live in the women's quarters. The men would live in the men's quarters. They would share in the responsibilities of maintaining the community and whatever, you know, manufacturing business they were in. They would share that. So they would share the wealth and they would share the poverty. They would share everything. But there was no sex. And anybody that joined who was married could no longer live with their wife, no longer have, you know, marital relations. That was the foundation of the Shaker movement.
That's a huge sacrifice for somebody to sacrifice to believe in their religion.
Well, you know, then you think of nuns and monks.
That's true, too.
You know, some people, they felt that that was not a sacrifice. This was their passion. They loved God. They were willing to give that up to continue their beliefs.
And in some respect,
and in some, not everybody is as, you know, active as others.
Well, and in some respects, that would take away a lot of problems, you know?
Well, you know, think of women, you know, in a society where you don't own anything and your only choice as a woman for a long time was to get married or to stay single as the aunt working in your brother's or your sister's household as their nanny, as their cook, as their housekeeper.
Right.
You know? Maybe they didn't want to do that. They wanted to be an independent individual within a Shaker environment where you were truly an individual.
Yeah,
you know, you weren't part of something else. You were part of this group, but you weren't the servant in a household.
Right.
And so a lot of people chose that. A lot of women chose that kind of a life because it gave them an independence that they would never have on the outside.
Right.
So I understood that. That made some sense. So anyways, Mother Anne Lee is the woman who's credited with coming to America with, I think it was seven people. One of them was her husband that she no longer was intimate with, but he came with her.
Right.
And she came to North America to establish the Shakers in North America because of a vision she said she had from God. And she said, I saw in a vision the Lord Jesus in his kingdom and glory. He revealed to me the depth of man's loss, what it was, and the way of redemption therefrom. Then I was able to bear an open testimony against the sin that is the root of all evil. And I felt the power of God flow into my soul like a fountain of living water. From that day, I have been able to take up a full cross against all the doleful works of the flesh.
Yes,
that was absolutely the thing. Oh, it was eight followers. So they sailed on May 19th, 1774,
okay,
from Liverpool to America. And because they couldn't take the oath of allegiance, because they were Quakers, Shakers, they were imprisoned. But the populace just felt that was unfair, and after 6 months they were allowed to be out. They were able to get out of jail and carry on their lives in North America. There's different stories. Some say that she was the Jesus Christ come back, the second coming of Christ.
Wow. Okay.
Other people say that was said of her after she died. So I'm not really sure which one it is, but I know for sure that after she passed away, which was, I think, in 1784, her followers viewed her as Jesus Christ reborn.
Okay.
And they firmly believe that that's who she was. And within the Shaker world, women played a very strong role, and they were a central role in running the organization. So Mother Ann Lee was the first female. After her, there was a couple of guys. And then after them, we had Lucy. What's Lucy's last name? Anyways, it'll come to me. So Lucy became the leader of the Shakers, and it was with Lucy that Eunice butted heads. Because what happened is James tried to convince Eunice to join him at the Shakers. And Eunice would go up there and visit with them and would look and go, I don't think I want to be celibate, and I want my husband back because I want my life back, and I want you to be with our children. I don't want to be hungry, you know, that kind of thing. But I, you know, the trade-off can't be that I join the Shakers and live as a celibate woman and I have no connection with my children, because the children would no longer live with her either. So she rejected that. So then another time, James comes back from Watervliet, which was their home base and the Shaker home base, and said, okay, the Shakers are going to allow you to live in a house nearby with the kids, and I'll live with you. And so she went up there to Watervliet to check out if that story was true. And she left her children behind with her sister, and she got there and they told her, nah, that's absolutely not going to happen. So he had misled her. But there was a reason for that. She was actually being lured away by James, and James was taking the time to zoom back to Durham, and he stole his children. And he took them back to the Shaker village while Eunice was returning to Durham. So here we got this kind of thing going on where she's returning home. The children have been stolen from her, and he's got the children up in Watervliet with the Shakers. And the indoctrination and the brainwashing of the children begin.
Okay.
So the story behind her really is her fight to get that divorce. And the second part of that story is her fight to get her children back.
Okay.
And so it's a fascinating story, and that's what the three-part story with the Greenville Pioneer is all about. And it's about the three-year fight, cajoling, convincing. I'm not exactly sure everything she did up in Albany to get those legislators to agree to vote and give her that legislative divorce. But she got it eventually. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, James had disappeared with the children into another Shaker community. She didn't know where they were.
Okay.
And so she, the second part of her story was locating the children, which ended up in, they were up in Enfield, New Hampshire, and how she got up to Enfield, New Hampshire, and was able to actually steal back her son. She roused the populace there to fight for her. She was a very good orator. She wrote a book that she was published about what the Shakers did to kids and what they did to families, destroying the children and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And so that's the whole story, is she got her oldest son back, and then a few years later was able to get her two daughters back, and it took her a while to deprogram them from the Shaker life. But her young son grew up to be a multimillionaire, a slumlord, married a few times, had an illegitimate daughter, and was very wealthy in Brooklyn. And they died owning a huge amount of money. Her story is a story of resolve. It's a story of passion. It's a story of anger. It's a story of a woman fighting for her rights.
Very salacious.
It is an incredibly great story. If anybody's interested in reading about it, I invite you to get the Greenville Pioneer articles from this last week and the previous issue. Go to www.greenvillepioneer.com. And the third part of this article, which tells the tale of how she got her children back, will be coming out next week. And if you really want to read the full details, I invite you to get the book by Il-Yon Wu called The Great Divorce, which was published in 2010. It's an amazing read. And it's all about this young woman, Eliza Hawley, who married James Chapman in what was called New Durham, New York at the time, and her fight for her freedom and independence as a woman.
Well, thank you, Sylvia. Thank you
You're
for
welcome.
Joining us again on this festive seventh day of the WGXC Radio Magic Winter Pledge Drive. You definitely have piqued interest, which will help us out, and that is much appreciated. You will be back here next month, and maybe...
We'll talk about Sam.
Yeah, you might show up with old Uncle Sam with us.
Because I've written that story before already.
Yes. Okay, so we're going to get into that hopefully next month.
Absolutely.
Please, anybody, everybody, give us a call here at 518-697-7400. You can go online to wgxc.org/donate. And we have many, many premiums that we will be giving you if you contribute to our pledge drive, as well as tax deductible, which goes in with Uncle Sam, right?
Oh, yes.
So if you want to hear Uncle Sam and also get tax deductible, just give us a call here at 518-697-7400. We had a great show, I think. I want to thank you again, Sylvia. I want to thank you again.